All right, welcome to another podcast of the Magnus and Marcus Show. Joined as always by John Marcus. How are you doing, John?
Can't complain, man. Happy to be back talking about what we love doing, coaching and thinking.
Good, exactly. So this week we decided to talk about a topic that I think will be really interesting. That's kind of almost like a reflective piece in a way. It's interesting to look back. I mean, we're both about the same age in our coaching progress. To kind of look back and see how we got to this point. Not that we're at some great defined finish point, but it's kind of cool to see how we've progressed to this point and how we've evolved as coaches. And you know, I think hopefully that will help some of the other young coaches trying to find their way and understand what they should learn and all that good stuff. So I guess to start off, let's start off with how did you get into coaching, or when did you first know, and what was the process like of figuring out what to learn?
Oh man, I think for me it started in college with my college girlfriend, who was a year younger than me. Her name was Danielle Padilla, a pretty good middle distance runner for us at Columbia at the time, about low 420s, 419 or so. So really, with her, I was kind of more, you know, her sounding board about the process or psychological components rather than just X's and O's running training. She really wasn't getting that kind of attention initially from her college coach, the woman's coach at the time, just because she was young, she wasn't as fast. There were some big women's dogs that needed a lot of her attention, so I was really helping nurture Danielle and also kind of trying to find answers myself about different ways to like approach the psychology of, you know, racing, training, being consistent, and putting it all together. And I mean, ever since then, it was interning at summer camps, just kind of coaching at kind of high school age clinics in the winter or in the summer. And then, you know, right out of school, after graduating college, just went right into coaching high school. I mean, went back to my alma mater. Helped coach cross country and track. Then spent a little while as actually the head women's soccer coach there because I have a soccer background. So I was coaching soccer, women's soccer, cross country, track year round, and it was awesome. And then finally said, hey, want to take it to the next level and get into college, and just worked my way up through there. And also had, you know, blessed enough to have a good enough reputation and a lot of people available in the Portland area who have been running and racing and continuing to race both collegiately, and we're able to work with them. And here we are now talking about what we love coaching. So pretty natural progression. I think I was always meant and destined to be a coach. There was nothing else really that I wanted to do once I realized I wasn't going to be a pre-med, you know, be a doctor. I kind of figured that out early. I got weeded out in organic chemistry. So I was one of the, you know, the people that weeded out. Okay, I was like, ooh, not for me. I'm out. So, yeah. Oh, what about you, Steve? Yeah, take us through your progression now.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, I'd say my coaching started out with my own failure as a runner. I was having some tough times in college and wanted to understand what the heck was going on. So, I really kind of got interested in that. And, you know, actually in college, started coaching high school kids at my alma mater high school, and really started as a way to kind of give back and get my mind off my own running and kind of almost selfishly refine that love of sport a little bit. So, and I definitely did, like, working with those high school athletes, like, kind of re-engaged and reminded me why I did stuff. And it also challenged me as a coach to kind of take a step back and figure out how to do things. So, I mean, I find it both interesting that we both started at the high school level, because I think a lot of times in college you get coaches who jump straight from college running to volunteering at college and whatever, and never experience that kind of growth at the high school level. But anyway, so from there, went on to grad school, continued coaching a little bit, got blessed with a couple of post-colleges to coach at that time. And then ended up out in Oregon coaching professionals and that stuff, which was a little bit non-traditional of a route, I admit. And then kind of segued back into college coaching here at Houston, and and kept the professional thing going. So it's kind of been a roundabout journey, but have been fortunate enough, just like you, to coach at pretty much every level, which I think brings a little bit different perspective.
Okay. I think you and I have had these conversations offline a lot about, you know, having coached professionals or, you know, what is considered really, really fast national or world-class type athletes, you know, whether it's 15-30 type gals for 5K or sub-4-minute milers for men. And at a certain point, you know, being blessed to have the opportunity to work with that caliber of athletes so early, you kind of understand and lose an ego that coaching is coaching all the same, or, you know, whether you're trying to coach a kid to run a sub 4:30 mile or coach a, you know, professional to try to run a sub 3:50 mile, you know, it's, there's still the same elements, basic elements to play. And it's nice that, you know, we really, I feel like, have a good head on our shoulders, or attempt to have a really good head on our shoulders, to take the ego out of, oh, well, I coach so and so this, so and so that, and so and so this, which, you know, unfortunately sometimes can become, you know, all too common of a demeanor in our sport, in any profession. I mean, it's competitive. I get it. You know, like, that's the way of the world. I feel blessed to have had the experience that I had so young. So it really allows me to get back to the fundamentals of what coaching is, which is teaching and education of the physical, rather than simply being in that kind of business side of running at the professional ranks, where it's the business of running, the business of winning. You know, X's and O's, you don't get it done, you don't have a contract, or your contract's terminated type deal. So I think that's maybe why you and I have, you know, found ourselves back in the scholastic ranks, or firmly rooted in the scholastic ranks at the college level, because there is, and especially at a mid-major level, rather than necessarily a power conference level, because there is that, you know, semblance of purity, of pure development, true development of, unrecruited kids, unheralded kids out of high school, or, even junior colleges, and you really get to work with them and capture their hearts and minds to have them kind of explode into the consciousness of, you know, the national scene of whether it's collegiate, junior ranks, or hopefully one day American ranks. That sometimes you just don't get at our level.
Exactly. No, I think that's a great point, because, I mean, I remember, you know, when I first got into the coaching world, is it's like anything. You have aspirations to coach the best, to teach people to the best, and there's almost like this mystique of working with really good athletes. Like, you think, oh my god, this guy's run, you know, 3:50 whatever for a mile, or this gal's run, you know, 15:20 for 5K, and because they've done that, they're like, you know, something super special and out of this world and like nothing you've done before. But I think the realization you have is that good, hardworking, dedicated kids are the same regardless of the performance level, right? So I've had athletes who have run, you know, 4:30 miles have the same level of dedication and all that as some of my best elite athletes. And then getting those kids to improve is the same kind of fundamental programs and problems that you run into. It's not like there's some magic mystique, and I'd agree completely. I mean, I feel very fortunate to have worked with some really good athletes at a relatively young age, and almost gotten that out of the way, where it's like you take a step back and you ask yourself, all right, why do I do this? Why do I get into coaching? And I think you hit the nail on the head. It's development and getting people to do and believe they can do things that they didn't think they could do, right? And that's whether that's taking a walk-on and making a walk-on kid in college who ran 4:40 run 4:20, or it's taking, you know, your 4:08 stud miler out of high school and making them national class. I mean, it's all coaching, and I think that's something that's sometimes lost if you haven't gotten to experience working with some pretty good athletes, is that mystique doesn't go away, right? It's almost like you need that balloon pop to be like, oh, okay, like all these people are just normal, like normal people just like you and me. So there's nothing inherently magical. They're just really dedicated and have some talent and put in the work to do it.
Right. You know, I sum that up in a nice little metaphor of what's the difference between a really crisp, brand new $20 bill and a really old, dilapidated, you know, $20 bill that's, you know, been on the ground, been in someone's wallet, you know, has a couple stains on it, you know, nothing. The inherent value of the $20 bill, or the brand new one, or the, you know, wrinkly and old one, is exactly the same. It's the value is $20. And the same thing about you as a person and a coach, you know, or a human being. It's, you know, whether you're in this position coaching at this power school or in this position coaching this middle school team, your inherent value of a coach doesn't change, even though the resources and talent level around you does significantly change. And I think sometimes when you come to have that aha moment, and then you start to really gravitate more toward learning from coaches' coaches, rather than learning from just the most successful coaches. And, you know, thankfully, a lot of times the more successful coaches are coaches' coaches. But, you know, people like, I think that our age don't really have a whole lot, you know, when we're talking about late 20s, early 30s type coaches, don't have a lot of familiarity with, like, say, the Vern Gambettas or Cliff Rosaltos. Like, those type of coaches' coaches are out there, very, very accomplished, very, very knowledgeable, but not necessarily in the forefront of the media juggernaut spotlight all the time, even though they're some of the most knowledgeable minds in the game coaching and teaching currently alive in, you know, the U.S.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think there's a whole class of coaches I'd call who are coaches who are kind of under the radar, who are on, I almost rely on for some of the more difficult problems, but never get the kind of press that they probably deserve. So, you know, almost using that as a stepping point, how have you found, like, your evolution as a coach? Like, if we were to take John Marcus in college, helping your girlfriend out at the time, what did you think was important at that time that you might have shifted viewpoints on now?
Well, I think whenever you start something new, you need to get a basic grasp of the fundamentals. So you can't really conceptualize what advanced calculus is if you don't already know what you know, basic arithmetic, geometry, trigonometry, algebra looks like. And so, like anyone in the classical style of Western contemporary civilization education, I start with the fundamentals. So going out and understanding metabolism, metabolic responses in running and distance running and endurance running, and how, you know, there are different processes within the body and with the rest to recovery ratio, and, you know, just the super compensation cycle, all the basic foundational stuff that's out there in kind of the coach's vernacular and consciousness, so to speak. And it was really hammering on those things, like, you know, Daniel's, you know, Peter Koh's book, you know, Bowerman's system, Lydiard, you know, Percy Curry, you know, all those types of, you know, pillars and those foundational figures of the early 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s that really kind of figured out the recipe before the science was necessarily there to validate and back up what they had already figured out. So, you know, it started a heavy, heavy degree with that, but then it started my trajectory of my self-learning, my self-education changed as, you know, my mentors changed, as well as, you know, I already kind of got what I felt was a firm grasp of all that foundational technique and basic understanding of the science or the biochemistry component, but very, very basic without getting an advanced degree in school or anything. So then move forward into understanding what, taking a step back and seeing more global perspectives about each athlete you're working with. Like, all right, we may want to, you know, write a training cycle or a training plan for a season, a macro cycle or something, but what happens when, you know, Johnny breaks up with his girlfriend? What happens when Susan gets a new boyfriend? You know, do they become a little disengaged or a little too emotional? And understanding that these subtle things, like we talked about in the podcast before, what happens away from the track, away from our watchful eyes, coaches, have much greater impact than we think, than about the small period of time of our influence being able to do these activities in the here and now. And so it's really become more about how do you craft an environment and a culture within your team or within your group of people, or even your one-on-one relationships if you're working, you know, one-on-one with an athlete. You know, how do you create this culture of expectation, excitement, enthusiasm, and also ability to succeed through failure, through learning, but yet keep people accountable towards what their end game goal is for that particular season or your particular period of time that you're in that coach-athlete relationship. And so, you know, it's gradually a lot more towards leadership books, Simon Sinek, you know, Start With Why Leaders Eat Last, you know, really empowering books that I've, you know, read in a couple years prior, and last year his book, Leader, or Why Leaders Eat Last, or Leaders Eat Last, you know, in 2014. One of my favorite books of 2014, you know, huge influence on me. You know, obviously, I think he has, you know, the most viewed TED Talk in all of TED Talk history on YouTube. So, you know, he's a juggernaut in leadership and leading the right way. And he relayed a story once in Leaders Eat Last about just our conception of titles and how titles, aren't necessarily all they're made out to be. And you have to understand, like, if you can shed your title and create a personal, realistic relationship with someone outside of a title and have an understanding as human beings in life, trying to live life vibrantly, have good adventures and get the most out of life, then, you know, whatever title or role you're playing in a relationship dynamic, that then allows you to understand, like, to have that kind of mutual respect for people throughout the, you know, the course of their existence, and then also convey to them the necessity for them to respect you through the course of their existence and what they're trying to accomplish. So, you know, I think it's this graduation from the X's and O's, so to speak, to kind of more metaphysical, philosophical, relationship-type literature and mentorship. And actually what I ask my mentors now more than anything is not how to patternize training or when and where we should do certain type of workouts or what magic secret workout is there. It's more of a, hey, the social dynamics going on or the relationship dynamics like this, how do we enhance this or improve this or repair this moving forward based on your experiences of decades and decades of coaching and just being a people person?
Yeah, I think those are some great ideas and an interesting progression because, you know, I mean, I didn't know you until we were both far along into this progression, but my kind of knowledge base followed a very, very similar path. I mean, once I started getting into coaching, I was fortunate enough to have a really good mentor in Tom Telez, who was, you know, coach of Carl Lewis, Leroy Burrell, famous sprint coach, who actually started as a distance coach at the junior college level. But when I was really getting into coaching and asking him, like, okay, how do I do this stuff? He's like, number one, you have to learn your fundamentals. So what you have to do is read, ask questions, learn enough. It won't make sense right now, but if you keep pressing along and keep understanding, eventually the clouds are going to part and you're going to have this great model in your head of how everything works.
Right, you're going to see patterns, which is coaching. That's so awesome, Steve. Like, yeah, he just basically tells you, keep reading because you'll see patterns, and that's like Obi Wan Kenobi 101 of coaching.
Exactly, and that's it, and that's how it works. I mean, I remember when I was really young, and I'd go out and spend time on this ranch, and he'd sit there, and he'd have all these printed out, you know, coaches, articles or, you know, science articles, and I'd sit there and like, oh, you have so many of this. And he's like, yeah, but now I'm at a point where I can read the first paragraph and I'll know whether I want to read it or not or anything like that. And as a 18, 19 year old kid, I was like, what the heck? Like, that doesn't make sense. But his pattern recognition ability was so good that he could just spot it right there. And now, you know, a decade later, I can completely understand that. And I think that's what it is. It's getting those fundamentals down where you have to establish where you know what good patterns are. So, you know, that's where I started. And it wasn't – I have this reputation as more of a science-based coach for reasons because I kind of branded myself that.
Exactly. Yeah, a book called The Science of Running. It's hard to shed that.
That's my fault on that. But, you know, the other other really good thing, again, from Coach Telez was he said, no, you got to go back and read the classics. So my education in terms of distance running coaching was reading stuff like, you know, Fred Wilt's book from like 1950, Run, Run, Run. And, you know, another classic on biomechanics called by Jeffrey Dyson called The Mechanic of Athletics. And, it was all these, you know, Percy Cerruti, original Lydiard. It was all these historical texts that gave me this understanding, just like you said, of guys who figured out what worked without any of the science stuff. And this is what worked, and this is why we did it. And you could almost see like this evolution of training to see where we got. And then from there, I tagged on some of the science understanding stuff, mostly because I was going to school there. And it made sense. But, you know, after that, it was that branching out, just like you said. It was more, I considered it, all right, I have this huge foundation. I understand the history. I understand the science. Now I'm going to try and connect as many kind of disparate ideas as I can and bring it back. And it's been since then, you know, the past probably 3-4 years plus, it's been kind of process orientated, learning. How do we learn? How do we handle decision making? What's the psychology behind it all? It's all kind of understanding the whys and the process behind what we do, because I think that great once you get to be a good coach, it's connecting things and making it understandable, and not so much as the X's and O's. Don't get me wrong, the fundamentals are really important. But once you get them down, it's just straight pattern recognition, right? So not to belabor the point, but when I was young, I used to spend so much time writing plans and workouts and all this stuff, because I thought, oh, I have to have like this. This is what matters, right? But after doing it for so long, it's, you see the athlete, you see how they handle this, and it's like, oh, well, I've seen this before. This connects to this. I need to do this now. And it's not even, it's not this long planned out thing. You have this overarching goal, overarching, you know, pattern and plan, but it's more just kind of letting all that knowledge work and having faith in it and the stuff surrounding it that matters more.
Right. I mean, it's the wisdom that knowing that one workout can't make an athlete, but one workout can break an athlete. And I think when you come to that concrete wisdom through your coaching practice, like, that's a really good North Star for everything and anything that you're doing. I mean, it's kind of, you know, we talked about Tom a little bit, you know, being kind of a throwback to a lost generation of track and field coaches that could coach every event. You know, now we get in this era of hyper-specialization where, you know, you got speed power coaches that are only coaching, you know, flat running events, not even coaching hurdle events. You got distance coaches that are only coaching anything from a mile and up and, you know, don't know how to coach a shot put event. And you got throws coaches. I mean, you know, your best coach in many, many college teams these days are multi-coach, because they have to have a fundamental understanding of a lot of different disciplines and how disciplines they relate. But like Tom started off as distance coach, but man, that guy coached everything. And it was kind of funny because I was thrusted as a young track coach on my track team in high school where I was coaching into the sprint hurdle role, because we didn't have a sprint hurdle coach, and my distance coaches or great distance coaches for the high school ranks were there. Like, they didn't need another distance coach. So I had to learn about all the different energy systems, technique, everything associated with like the sprint hurdle department really quick. And that's actually where I started off a lot of my coaching, you know, when I moved over. I mean, I coached the decathlete at a small NAIA high school or Pacific, as well as steeplechase or a 10K guy or like national qualifiers for NAIA. And then when I was at University of Portland, I was helping with the men's distance, male distance program, but also the women's sprinters and hurdlers, you know. And it's like, I needed to know what those energy systems were, because that made my distance-to-distance coaching all the more better. And so, because it forced me out of my comfort zone and what we usually think are the most critical factors. Because again, unfortunately, in this day and age, there's not a lot of interdisciplinary talk between the specialized schools and specialized events on the track. You know, I mean, how many times have you and I been to, you know, a coaching conference and saying, yeah, we don't need to go to the distance thing. Let's go to the throws things or the sprint or the jumps and just see what they're doing and see if we can glean any new information or catalyze any new thought process based on what they champion as very important parts of training in those disciplines, you know, versus what we do. So,
exactly.
You know, that's, you know, I wish there were more of those Tom Telezes out there in this day and age. Unfortunately, it really is the cliche of a dying breed. I don't think we'll ever see that type of person again, save maybe middle school or high school type ranks.
Exactly. No, that's a great point. It's kind of funny, actually, talking about coaches' conferences and going to other event groups, because it challenges your system of thought, right? So a lot of times, like, you go to the, you know, big coaching conferences, and people just keep sharing the same things. And, hey, it works, so it makes sense, right? But there's no challenging beliefs. There's no stepping outside your comfort zone and making you ask questions of why you do that. And I think that's a wonderful thing, is if you go to a high school or college coaching clinic, is check out the other events. Because you take away so much. I mean, so Tom made me learn every single event. I mean, I might not be able to do it that great, but I have an understanding of it because he forced me to freaking learn it all. And that's how, you mentioned high school coaches. I think that's another great thing about really good high school coaches, are forced to be able to understand every event, because they can't specialize, because it's, if you're the head coach, you might have, you know, one or two helpers who come out after football or basketball season or something. And you're the go-to guy. You know, my high school coach was when I was started in as a freshman in high school, he was a sprint jumps coach for 25 years of his career. And then he took over the cross country team. And he went from, you know, the year before coaching a guy who went 10-2-8 in the 100 as a high school kid. He was number one in the nation. And then, you know, 4 years later, I was number one in the nation in the mile. And it was this ability to coach different events and understand different events completely. And not, you know, what I learned from him is he had this background as a sprinter, right? But he didn't view the world through that sprint background, which I think sometimes happens, right?
Yeah.
Once he was coaching, exactly. Once he was coaching distance, he transitioned best he could to viewing the world through more of a distance lens, right? So, not to belabor the point, but if you go and learn other events, is learn them through their viewpoint. Keep your own whatever, but try and understand it through their viewpoint. Okay, because, you know, the worst thing I see happening is sometimes, like, I'll get in conversations with sprint coaches. They'll be like, you got to focus on this, this, and this, and this, and this. And it's like, okay, that might be true to a point, and I get what you're saying, but you got to step back and understand what's the importance in our world, and then how do we take your ideas and apply it to that?
Right, yeah, posture and biomechanics are important if you're Mofra, you know, or, you know, Katie Mackey, because you're trying to get that extra 1% because you've already maximized your, you know, metabolic ability. But, you know, you don't need to harp on posture and biomechanics if you have, you know, Division One college woman who's a 440, 1500 meter runner. I mean, you need to get her down to a 430, 420 before that becomes really a critical factor. Yes, those will help get her there. But it's more about, exactly that, developing the things that have the biggest bang for your buck early, and then, like we talked about before, you know, that clean slate, okay, now we can work on and really harp on this, because this is going to help enhance you even more, and it just, it goes further, there's a longer tail associated with it. You know, exactly, I think, you know, shifting a little bit from X's and O's and talking about, you know, one of my biggest influences and mentors, Rob Connor, over at University of Portland, like, he is a genius. He's probably one of the most brilliant distance minds in the collegiate ranks right now that I've been exposed to and made aware of. And I just won't say that because, you know, I worked with him for a couple of years, but I say that because the genius in him lies in how he creates culture and how he has created culture at UP. And it's amazing when I tell people, or even athletes who are, come from that program who take a year somewhere else at another program, when they're like, really, Rob gave you all that autonomy to decide how far you're going to run on workout days? I mean, we literally, this is a standard practice at UP. You know, we go to the forest, Forest Park, which is a 5,000 acre, you know, forest in the city limits of Portland, and with 80 miles of soft crushed gravel, running trails. And you're like, all right, how far is everyone going? the day. And the guys just knew from being indoctrinated into the program that the younger guys need to go a little shorter for their recovery runs, and they need to get recovered, and the older guys need to put in a little bit more volume. The guys who are a little bit more seasoned and a little bit more, you know, faster national class guys could run a little faster. And he didn't need to go and preset and remind them that. They just knew because it was passed down from senior, junior, upperclassmen to underclassmen throughout the ages at UP because he's been there so long. But he's always made a point of he listens to his team about what they need to do. If you know, their seniors or captains come after a cross-country season, hey, coach, you know, we think we need to run a little bit, you know, longer tempo runs at a harder pace next year to be more competitive at the Nationals. Or, hey, coach, we need to run more miles. Or, hey, coach, we need not do as much, you know, speed training and compromising overall volume early. He'll make that adjustment based on the feedback from his team rather than being in this kind of, you know, very patriarchal driver's seat of saying, my way, this is what we're doing, and we're controlling every single day. And, we had a guy, Stephen Kirsch, that was at UP when I was there, recently went to, program back east. And, you know, the coach at that program back east could not believe that, you know, Rob did not prescribe paces and distances on the non-workout days. He just couldn't believe it. He's like, because he was just very regiment about doing that, and, you know, had to be, you know, in a certain degree, at a certain pace because of this training cycle. And he was very precise. But the brilliance of Rob is his ability to read the athletes really quickly and attune to them. And so he may have this session planned out where you're going to, you know, do 1,000-meter repeats, 10 times a K repeats at this pace, this less rest. And if it's not going well, don't worry about it, dude. Just cut it. We'll get back later. No worries. You know, or, oh, man, you're looking really good. Let's add two more. You know, it's just kind of like him. He's so attuned, you know, about, and they're so real about what matters. What matters is, like he taught me, what matters is being ready to go on workout day, because that's the day you're practicing about being ready to go on race days. You know, you didn't have a good night's sleep. If you're not feeling that hot, they're not going to change the race day for you, the race time. The race is still going to be ran, so you got to learn how to go, even if you don't feel awesome and 100%. But you also have to be communicative if you're really feeling crummy that day. And, you know, adjustments can be made. But, you know, the message always was, hey, guys, get what you need to get done in so you get better, so you recover, so we can get some good work in on the workout days and be ready to go on race day when they come up. And it was just, you know, as a younger coach, really instrumental in my maturity and learning process to really say, you don't need to control that much. You can step back a little bit. You can give autonomy to these mature athletes, you know, your high school juniors or seniors or your college-age athletes or professionals, say, hey, you know what you need to do to get the goals accomplished on that recovery day or between workouts or races done, so do it. We'll check back in on the workout day and get you better, you know, moving forward as that as the more critical thing that I need to track and be in control of. So it's this interesting kind of, really balanced relationship. It wasn't just a coach saying, I'm going to run everything all the time and you guys are going to oblige what I want to do because essentially I tell people, like, look, the best coaches will tell you straight up front that we're all guessing. We are guessing. We don't really necessarily know if 8x800 is better than 6x800 with 6x200-meter repeats afterwards, or if, you know, 10x a K at 255 pace is really better than 8x a K at 254 pace. I mean, we can say it's better or we can, you know, justify it. But at the end of the day, the stimulus differential is so slight. The magnitude of it's so, and we're talking like seconds. You know, I remember, you know, one day arguing with Alan Webb at the track about running a 30-second 200. We're talking about 30 seconds. We're talking about 30 seconds here. I went to like an Allen Iverson rant here. 30 seconds. not talking about minutes. Talking about seconds. Like, just don't do it, you know? But he was really protesting it that day. It didn't make him feel good. I was like, okay, fine, then don't do it. But sometimes we lose that intelligence of that, and we're filled with so much self-importance because we're controlling these numbers on a piece of paper or on a stopwatch. And I was actually just telling Post Media this weekend. It's like, you know, we could call seconds. Seconds couldn't be seconds. It could be something else. It could be a Googleplex matrix. And it's like nine of those for 800 meters. If you run 9 Googleplex matrix, that's a good time. It's just a standardized measurement that we put a lot of investment and a lot of urgency in as an importance as coaches, because it's just a standardized method of measure. If the standardized method of measure was different, that would be the most important thing, because we have this feeling that we can control standardized methods of measure. You can't necessarily control someone's emotional excitement, emotional sense of purpose, clarity. Those are things that are so vital to the well-being and capability of an athlete, but that we can't necessarily control from a quote-unquote scientific background, or from a scientific fashion, that it just becomes in something we don't really talk about that much, because, oh, it's just, we're talking about your feelings, it's more wishy-washy, this or that, you know? It's like, that's actually very, very critical. If someone's not happy in life, if they're depressed, but they have all this talent, but they are depressed because, you know, a friend or a close friend or loved one died, they're not going to compete well. You know, it doesn't matter if the competition venue is a track, the business arena, the classroom, whatever, it's not going to happen. And you got to solve that problem before you can say, oh, well, you know, we'll just get you back on the track. You're fit, you're fast. You can go run a sub 4 minute mile, no problem. And it's like, well, why is he running 4:15? Because he's super depressed, dude. You know, I mean, it's pretty simple. So, I mean, I just, you know, shout out to Rob Connor, who, you know, really taught me a lot in that arena, and, you know, very, very thankful for those lessons so early, because I would not want to be the coach I was 7 years ago, 10 years ago, that I am today, because I don't think I would be able to help inspire the athletes I work with as effectively as I do now. So, because learning that emotion, the critical importance of that emotional component, so vital.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I like to call it, we overemphasize what we can measure. So because we have a stopwatch, we can measure it. We're going to emphasize the crap out of that because it's something we can control. And I'm right there with you. I mean, we have athletes. It's funny. We have athletes on our easy in-between recovery days. We have some who like running 5:50 pace. We have others who like running 7-minute pace on occasion. And I don't really care. Because they're doing what they need to do to get to the next day in a good state. Mm-hmm. And some feel like they got to run a little bit faster. Some feel like they got to run a bit slower. It doesn't matter. And I think that's a valuable thing to give them the autonomy to make those decisions. It's the same, like we were doing a workout, a longer, some miles and 12s this morning. And, you know, some of the guys are like, well, I feel really good. Can I go? And I'm like, go for it. You know, you don't have to stick to paces. If you feel it, go for it. Use that day, right? It doesn't have to be exact. And I think as coaches, sometimes we get locked into this idea of like, oh, I can control this. I got to have this exactly the way it is. And it's why I hate things that and coaches' education that teach, like, oh, you have to run at this percent speed, this percent heart rate, yeah, this percent to max. Like, it doesn't matter. I mean, are you telling me that on every given day, if it's going to be the same, is, you know, is this person need to run at 95% VO2 max? What if his dog died? I guarantee you that effort's not going to be the same, right? What if they broke up? What if he's elated from, you know, he's just the best day of his life and he's just clicking? Well, you know what? His emotional states, he's going to be primed to go. And these things, like, we're human beings. You can't quantify and take that into account. I mean, I'm a self-proclaimed science guy, and I know that. There's no way to measure any of that stuff. No. So,
well, we inherently learn by trial and error, right?
Yes. You're
saying, hey, don't touch the stove when it's on because the burner's hot as a little kid. And you're like, okay, yeah, but you don't know what the burner hot really is. You're told this, but you're like, okay, I won't do it. And you just trust that your parent or the adult that tells you this has your safety and well-being at heart, which they do. But what do? You touch the burner anyways, eventually. And then you learn, ow, that stings. That's really hot. Oh, my God. Okay, I'll never do that again. You know, and that's sometimes what people have to do. Like, you know, when guys or gals come back and have a really crummy workout or have a really crummy race, and I'm like, well, how did you feel the days preceding that, you know, win for you from a sleep, nutrition, and also activity standpoint? Like, oh, well, yeah, I ran, you know, the last couple runs all at 6-minute pace 3 days before the 10K, you know, track race, and you're 32-minute 10K runner for a guy, and it's like, hey, dude, that's probably way too much. You went in really super fatigued because you ran 3 days in a row at 6-minute mile pace, and your goal was to race at 5-minute mile pace. That's too close, man. That's too close. Next time, let's smile a little bit more.
Exactly. I mean, you got to let – it sounds bad, but you got to let kids fail sometimes to learn. And it's not setting them up, but I guarantee you, I mean, we went through that. We had one of our freshmen who was struggling a little bit early on in cross, and he was like, I'm killing workouts, but, you know, these races, they're not being put together. I'm like, Blake, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing in practice? It's like, well, I'm running pretty quick on my easy days. That's how I feel like I get better. I'm like, that's fine, but in the day or two leading up to it, are we trying to get better for the race? It's like, nope. It's like, okay, well, chill out. And you know, he kept the early week easy runs pretty quick. He likes doing that. But later in the week, he chilled out, right? And he started racing well. But it's that lesson that he had to go through that it's like making that connection, being like, oh, okay. Like, I know where my limit is. I know what I can do and what I can't do. Like, that's the thing that athletes need to understand is that they know their bodies. If they do it long enough, if they learn from it, they know their bodies better than me or you can, right?
Oh yeah, without a
doubt. They know their bodies. We're like the guides, especially as you get further along. We're the guides to make sure that, you know, their egos don't get in the way and they don't do something crazy when they shouldn't. But they know their bodies, and it's almost like giving them that ability and that autonomy to make those decisions based on knowing how they respond and how they feel.
Right, and that was a great teaching moment. You just, gave an example of Steve was exactly that, like saying, well, what were you doing? Having the person, the athlete, you know, go through that thought process of self-reflection of, well, I'm doing this, and I think it gets me better, and that's why I'm doing it. And then being, well, is it really getting you better? Are you really accomplishing that 1 or 2 days leading up to the race? You know, I do that to athletes, with my athletes all the time. I say, look, this workout is just a feel-good workout. There, you're not getting better. If there's a recovery penalty for having ran the speeds or distances you're running today, you know, for like 3, 4, 5 days out from a really important race or something, then you screwed up, you know. So, and I will tell, like, athletes, say, hey, all right, today the workout will be 1 mile, 2 times 8, 4 times 4, like a 5K or 10K guy, you know, when we're kind of towards the end of kind of peaking season. Look, I want you to run the mile at what feels like a good, sustained 10K rhythm. Don't look at the watch. Let the watch record, not direct. But just run by feel. Take as much rest as you need, and then run 2 times 800 at what feels like a good, solid 5K rhythm. Don't look at the watch. Take as much rest as you need to be able to feel in control of your capabilities for these quarters that are going to be at, like, you know, cutting down from 3K down to mile type speed, you know, and just feel it out. You know, don't get all, oh, well, today in practice, my goal is to run, you know, 68 for the 5K, and I'm struggling, you know, to run, you know, 72s, or today in practice, you know, I ran 65s for a mile, and it felt really easy. Oh, I'm going to crush this 5K. You know, we missed the mark. And I think, to me, it's always disappointing, you know, all coaches, all athletes put a lot of time and effort and energy into their preparations for racing and competing. But, you know, so many people miss the mark. And so many people don't get the PR, have the great championship race, or get the accolade they want, because somewhere in their process, they were a little bit, you know, in my opinion, a little bit too rigid about what they deemed as, you know, key performance indicators of control that really didn't have a high return on their investment. And I remind people too, like, the only time that it's like you got to have everything perfect, everything just, you know, streamlined and no stone unturned is for Olympians, because that's once every 4 years. But if you look at the rest of running, distance running, track and field world, there's a championship for cross, indoor and outdoor, and that happens every year. You know, there's how many road race championships for USATF? I mean, we had two on the same weekend this past weekend, the 15K and the marathon. Yep. Like, there's a lot of high-level opportunities that are very, very consistent throughout the year. So you goofed up at this one, indoors. well, then let's get it back outdoors. You all goof up outdoors, we'll get it back in cross country, you know.
Exactly. I mean,
you know, let's put the piece together. And that's the whole idea, the whole Scholastic, the reason the whole Scholastic, in my opinion, seasons are, you know, consistent like that from year to year, you know, season to season, is to give athletes this opportunity to calibrate by trial and error what works, what doesn't work, what's really competitive, you know, in their conference, in their region, in the national scene. And, you know, it just creates a good stepping stone and a good platform. You know, this will get on a different topic. You know, I'll touch on it briefly, something different about high school phenomena, you know, going straight, skipping their college eligibility and going straight to the pros. You know, they missed that critical calibration time of competing in a progressive fashion at a high level in the collegiate ranks. When you go from being the best high schooler in the country or history or whatever, straight to the pros, and they get the pros where it's like super duper cutthroat environment, and there's no progression. So you're, if you don't run good at this race, there's a lot of big potential consequences to it with contract, you know, reductions and yep. that. It's like, whoa, there's no room for error. Really, there's no room for error, you know?
Yep.
And that's what good teaching is allowing, that's what homework is. Homework is about correcting errors. That's what quizzes are about in the classroom. Going through, doing a checkup, seeing where the errors are, and correcting those failures and inaccuracies. So when you come to the final, when you come to the midterm or the paper or the group project that counts for everything, like the championship, you already have learned those lessons. That's why we run regular season track meets. So when we get to our championships, we've worked out the different kinks and, you know, vulnerabilities or, you know, bonehead strategies that might have happened earlier mid-season. So by the time you're there, you're running the best race you can run given your circumstances.
Exactly. No, those are some good points and another topic for sure. For sure. So we're running at about 45 minutes, so I'm going to cut it there.
We could go all night, man. This is a fun one. So.
Yeah. I know. Especially once you brought in the high school phenoms jumping.
No, maybe that's a pod for the future, man.
I think so. Because I know we have a bunch to say about that. But yeah, this was a lot of fun. Obviously, it dragged on for 45 minutes. So cool stuff, John. Thanks as always.
Yeah. Thanks, Stephen. Thanks everyone for listening. Hopefully, it was valuable as always.
Yeah. Good deal.